From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. called him the world's leading theorist of nonviolence. This hour, a conversation with civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson. Lawson studied nonviolent protest in India, helped desegregate lunch counters in Nashville, and was expelled from Vanderbilt University for it. He'll tell us how he faced overt racism as a boy, his work with Dr. King, and reflect on race and civil rights in the U.S. today. Lawson spoke in Iowa City yesterday evening. Then, later in the hour, we'll hear about the UNI School of Music's concert celebrating the Negro spiritual this weekend. That's coming up right after a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Most of this hour, we'll spend listening to a conversation I had yesterday with a remarkable figure from the civil rights movement, the Reverend James Lawson. Martin Luther King Jr. called him the world's leading theorist on nonviolence. His life has been marked by an abiding faith in Christianity and nonviolence, and a willingness to pay the price for those beliefs. He served 13 months of a 3-year prison sentence for refusing the draft during the Korean War and was expelled from Vanderbilt University in 1960 because of his work to help desegregate lunch counters in downtown Nashville. Lawson spoke at the Johnson County Senior Center yesterday evening as part of the center's celebration of the human rights movement and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I began by asking Reverend Lawson when and why he decided to become a Methodist minister.
I did not have a choice. I'm a third-generation Methodist clergy, and my father was a pastor, AME Zion Church, which was one of the branches of Methodism, and I felt the pull all my life.
There was no moment of a decision where you said, I'm going to dedicate my life to this.
No.
It was just obvious.
Yeah, I think I lived in a home where there's lots of love, and the St. James AME Zion Church was a very strong congregation, and I felt deeply engaged in it. And so I laugh and say I really didn't have a choice because it seemed that's where I was headed.
How did your faith inspire you to get involved in civil rights and the principles of nonviolence?
Because at age 4, my dad moved to this church in Massillon, Ohio. And it was in Massillon, Ohio, in the streets and the parks, that I met my first racial incidents that were hostile, name-calling, insulting.
Personally to you?
Yes, in the park, on the street, Tremont Street, where we lived.
What was the incident? Can we recall that?
Oh, no, many instances. Getting called the N-word, for an example, or Jungle Bunny. It was a regular occurrence. Through those years, I recognized I had to make a fundamental choice. Did I accept the definitions of who I was and am, given me by my family, my congregation, by God? Or did I yield to the prejudice and racism that I met without knowing that I was going to meet it?
What guidance did your family give you in how to deal with the outside world in this
bigotry?
Well,
basically my family by this time had persuaded me that I was, that I counted, that I was a boy, a human, and that I should live out of the context of that humanity, and the family and church context and community context gave me a profound sense of the love of God and the love of people. So my initial reactions to this was to fight, to smack the person or to engage in a fight. And how often that happened, I do not know. I do remember that on a couple of occasions, the boy was taller than I was and bigger, and I came away with a bloody nose, but with my heart undimmed in trying to teach him a lesson. I didn't say that back then, but that's basically, I think, what I was trying to do, to indicate, and it was my earliest response. Now, I should tell you that that response stopped, and it stopped decisively, the reason being this. In the fourth grade, we had my parents had bought a home five blocks away from Horseman Elementary School, and I rushed home one afternoon, beautiful afternoon after school, and my mother met me in the kitchen and said, I need for you to run an errand. I did the errands for my dad and mother in fourth grade. I ran off and did the errand, and was meant going up the street, and as I made a left turn, there was an automobile parked on my side of the street. On this warm day, the windows were wide open, the sun was shining and beautiful, and a youngster saw me coming, apparently a white youngster. As I got close to parallel to the car, this youngster stood up in the front seat and his shoulders and head outside the window and yelled the N-word at me, and I walked over and smacked him and went on and ran the errand. When I mentioned it to told my mother after I ran the errand and told my mother what about this incident, which is, as far as I know, the first only time I told her, she said, Jimmy, what good did that do? And then she did a kind of rehearsal of who I was and what we were about as a family and God and Jesus and whatnot and whatnot. What good did that do? And then she asked, the last question I remember, she said, Jimmy, there must be a better way. Now, she was very much opposed to any kind of fighting. Mm-hmm. And my dad was not, but she was. And so when I started school as a preacher's kid, I had to do some fighting. And my mother always advised me against it. Dad said, well, but they're messing with you, so go ahead and fight them and forget about it. So that was a profound experience. It's what the theologians call a numinous experience, what other psychiatrists today call the peak experience, and it changed my life. I made the decision that never again in the athletic, on the play field, or anywhere else would I let an incident occur that I would get angry about. And then I also made the decision that I would find the better way.
Undoubtedly informed your decision in 1951. You considered yourself a conscientious objector, refused to report for the draft in 1951. You served 14 months in prison?
14 months. And I really did not count myself a conscientious objector. I counted myself a draft resister, which was also around at that time. This occurred as I was studying the life of Jesus in the Scriptures. And that was the book I learned to read in early on, so it's been a favorite book. And I became enamored of Jesus, not in a dogmatic sense, because I threw off some of the dogma. By high school, I was questioning it. But the intellectual, spiritual, moral sense, the sense of this extraordinary human being of the first century, and the ideas about compassion and love stuck, the care of the neighbor. And so I realized that I could not obey things about prejudice and bias and segregation. And then that moved by the time I was in high school to my thinking that I could not join a police force or an army to go to war. But I registered anyway when I turned 18, mm-hmm. having not made up my mind. It wasn't clear yet to me. But by 1949, I sent my draft cards back. So I was a draft resister.
Couldn't you have gotten a deferment as
I could have had a deferment as a student, as a conscientious objector, as a pre-ministerial student. But I thought that would have been a cop-out. I think the government's recognition of both students and pre-ministerial and clergy allows the church not and Christianity in the United States not to have to deal with the issue of who Jesus is and whether or not in following Jesus we can be supportive of war and violence. And then in 1947, I read Gandhi extensively and recognized that Gandhi was saying what I was trying to practice and did not call it pacifism, which I thought was not the word I wanted. And I called it, and so I began to then call myself nonviolence, and I began to study Gandhi.
In fact, you went to India as a Methodist missionary?
Missionary in 1953.
Did you know you were going there to collect tools to learn training for what you would later use in
Well,
Nashville?
I was practicing nonviolence, you see, in mm-hmm. college. And I sat in at restaurants that would not serve me, for an example. Gandhi is the father of the science of social change called nonviolence. This is something that academia has not caught up with yet. But he experimented for 50 years on how you dismantle injustice, how you stop, how on the one side you resist injustice, and on the other side how you create a better society. And so in his experimentation, he shows a methodology for social change that will be social change that has positive results. And he has theory that goes back to many people, including Jesus, that you can't get grapes, Jesus said, from a thistle bush. So
violence begets by violence.
Violence begets violence. Of course, Jesus said, you know, turn the other cheek, walk the second mile, love the enemy. And Gandhi read that also as a young man in South Africa. And so in the 20th century, Gandhi presented the term nonviolence for the first time. It's not to be found in written literature anywhere until South Africa, maybe 1906. When he coined the term nonviolence to represent his first major campaign against the South African government in their demeaning treatment of Indians in South Africa. So I did know because in college I had decided that we black folk in the United States were letting this stuff go on too long. Mm-hmm. And that we needed the Gandhian methodologies and use them for speeding up the change and for radically altering it.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Reverend James Lawson. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We continue now my conversation with Reverend James Lawson. Here he recounts his first meeting with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at Oberlin College in Ohio.
I shook hands with Martin King for the first time in February of 57. And Martin King and I had a chance to talk and we, you know, found a lot of things in common. Books and a lot of other stuff, and but the end result was that when he learned of my work in India and my study of nonviolence and all, that I thought that I would, after a couple of theological degrees, move south to pastor and work. He said, "Don't wait, come now. We need you now." So I went south and worked full time in the struggle as a troubleshooter. I gave the Little Rock Nine in 1958 their first workshop on nonviolent struggle. They were already in the midst of the Central High School and being battered and bruised, and their major instruction has been do not fight back, which they told me when I met them the first time, and I said, your parents and Mrs. Bates did not mean for you not to fight back. They meant for you not to fight back the way you're being battered. Don't cuss people out. And
so what is the instruction when you are violated most effectively? How can you resist with non-violence?
You do not let the assailant cause you to fear, and you do not accept the spirit of the assailant.
Accept the spirit. I mean, returning the hate.
The despising, the hate, the venom. And then you try to find a way to respond with calm and coolness, in exactly the opposite way of the assailant. And then in addition to that, if you can quickly figure out a surprise to the assailant, you do what Gandhi called, what Richard Gregg, rather, called more zuzitsu, because the assailant wants to stir you up, make you angry, make you fearful. And if you do not do that, that in itself upsets his plan and whatever's going on inside of him.
Do you have a surprise that you brought out in your personal experience in resisting?
Well, in one of the mob scenes in Nashville when we were desegregating theaters, the mob of young men that were following us back to the church, kicking us, spitting upon us, shouting in so many ways, I turned and looked at one of the boys in the face and said, did your parents teach you to act like that? And he stopped, and then I asked him, did your church tell you this is the way you should act? No, I think I asked him first, are you a Christian, a member of the church? He said, yes. I said, well, did your church teach you to do this? And he sort of stopped, and then he disappeared. He left the crowd at the back of our line. So,
you were a leader, I understand, in training. You trained many of the future leaders of the 1960s civil rights movement during your time in Nashville at the Divinity School of Vanderbilt University. Is that right?
No, not at the Divinity School, because I then enrolled back as a student and did the work part-time in the fall of 58. But the Nashville Christian Leadership Council, which organized to help continue the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 and nonviolence, we did a series of workshops to which we invited students. And so as a consequence of that, I was able to meet people like Diane Nash and John Lewis, Bernard Lafayette, Pauline Knight, a whole slew of people who got the training in those workshops, what Bernard Lafayette later called a boot camp. So these people did become SNCC staff people, Southern Christian Leadership Conference staff people, American Friends Service Committee staff people, and Congress of Racial Equality in the 60s. And Nashville became the breakthrough movement that one observer said reinvented the movement of the 60s.
You were expelled from Vanderbilt, though. What circumstances led to that?
Of my work in Nashville, when the reached a certain crisis in February of 1960, the afternoon newspaper and the president of one of the large department stores, who was also an ardent segregationist, both began to attack me, and they happened to be executive members of the executive committee of the Board of Trustees, which met the week after a major confrontation in downtown on Saturday downtown in the sit-in. And the net result was then they increased their attacks on us and on me particularly, and they panicked the chancellor of the university to expel me.
Ironic, now you are a distinguished professor of theology at Vanderbilt.
That was one of the turnaround. live long enough, you see lots of things happen that you may not have anticipated.
You have a direct connection with Dr. King's, the date of Dr. King's death in 1968. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you were involved in inviting him to Memphis.
I was the chairman of the strategy committee for the 1968 sanitation strike in Memphis. And the strategy committee represented the union and the community primarily. And one of the marches that we had, the police broke up with gassing, macing. About 1,100, 1,200 of us were peaceful on the street and marching towards a Mason temple. They broke it up with gas and did it deliberately. So when that happened, we knew that we had to work, and that's when the strategy committee was organized. And the first meeting, we said, well, let's begin mass meetings, which was a part of the movement's techniques. And then we said we must invite key figures from around the country to come in and speak. And so King was the third or fourth name that we wanted to come in. And since he and I were working together on so many fronts, I did the calling to invite him in on behalf of the movement. I'm deliberately taking the time to do this because people want to think that things happen by some kind of personality stuff, and that's important, and community is important.
Right.
But a movement has to be, can only be a movement like a sanitation strike with organizing and strategizing.
So we're forgetting
and
a lot. We're forgetting in historical perspective a lot of the details.
And we're forgetting it, and that hurts us because today we have a lot of protest and we have a lot of activism, but it is not as effective as it should be in primary. And the primary reason is because it is not geared to people taking their time to set goals and targets and specific strategies and techniques and organizing and recruiting people and training them so that the activism has a discipline that helps to dramatize the issue. And in the movement, you see, we had a social scene where when we walked into the Harvey's department store coffee shop and their white-colored signs in the department store, including over drinking fountains, that becomes a dramatic moment. And we're not swinging baseball bats. We're neatly dressed, and we sit quietly, and we ask for service, and we do not move. And then when we are taunted and harassed, we do not taunt and harass back. And those images, you see, is part of the power of nonviolent struggle, especially when within a society you are not intending to break away and form an independent state, or you're not intending not to live with all the people who live in the community. You want to stay where you are, and you want family and friends and churches and community to be a better community.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Reverend James Lawson. Lawson spoke last night at the Johnson County Senior Center. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's get back to my conversation with civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson. I asked Lawson about the causes he sees in civil rights and equality that are most pressing today.
The paramount one for me is that far too many people in the United States are influenced, whether they know it or not, by racism and its spiritual poison, by sexism, by violence, and by greed or materialism, or another way I talk about that sometimes, is plantation capitalism. Those are all deeply rooted in our history.
and we have learned the wrong lessons about humanity and about ourselves from them. And I would suggest that's the paramount issue facing the United States. We haven't dismantled the systems of racism, sexism, violence, and plantation capitalism. And these are the issues that thereby keep us from thinking straight. For an example, I just read the Nation magazine that came yesterday, and Katha Pollock has a sort of summary of where we are in sexism. Well, in the last few years, she was pointing out that in sexism, women are now making 77 cents on the dollar that men make, mm-hmm. as an example.
Right.
Well, that's part of what sexism is about. It's not only the language that we use about women and making them a sex object in the part of us male. It's not only patriarchy and our insistence that we men are the ones who are endowed with management and control and whatnot, but it is also ways in which we operate so that women are the fastest growing, are the largest group of poverty people in the United States. Women are the chief victims of Iraq and Afghanistan. Wherever there's violence and war going on, women are the ones who take it. Women are the chief victims of family abuse and the abuse of males in the United States. See, mm-hmm. So that's institutional. That's structured in the way in which we operate. So I maintain that there are many such operations going on in the United States that have been more influenced by racism than by compassion or love or a sense of freedom or a sense of responsibility.
Reverend Lawson, what do you make of the recent debate of justice, equality used in this debate as well in terms of its reference to marriage? Iowa is one of only a handful of states
right.
that now allow same-sex marriage. Proponents of same-sex marriage often argue that it is a civil rights issue, a matter of equality. Do you see it that way?
Since my days in the 1960s, as I have thought about what kind of a society I want, I've insisted that a healthy, mature society will be one where responsible adults will be able to form the families they want to form without the society battering them for one reason or another.
But doesn't your Christian faith
say
anything about marrying someone of the same sex?
No, there is no admonition to who you should marry in the Bible. The Bible is not a marriage manual anyway. And marriage in the Bible is more often a case of a man, one or more wives, and one or more mistresses or concubines. And where in the Bible culture, a woman is property. She has no identity apart from the male, father, husband, uncle, brother. She has no identity. She could not divorce when she was married, you know, and so forth. So I'm saying that the Christians who are battering something that they call marriage, and that gay and lesbian people should not have full human rights, are quite mistaken. The much larger law of life in the scriptures is you love God and you love your neighbor as yourself, and the love of neighbor is all neighbors, and having compassion for all neighbors is of more critical importance than cussing out gay and lesbian people. The Bible doesn't know anything about homosexuality or heterosexuality or sexuality. These are words that have developed as we human beings have worked on discovering ourselves in the 19th century. They're scientific words. They're medical words. There are no such words in the Bible.
Finally, Reverend Lawson, because in the next part of our program today, We'll be talking about a program, a celebration, a presentation at the University of Northern Iowa this weekend titled A Celebration of America's Cultural Treasure, the Negro Spiritual. I'd like to ask you going out here, what role you saw or you saw in Negro spirituals playing in the civil rights movement?
Well, of course, music was very, very much a part of our inspiration, our building our courage, our doing our planning, our thinking, our building the morale of the community. And the Negro spiritual in teaching we black folk has been a critical way, because the spiritual was largely invented by the people. Frederick Douglass says that the slave, the plantation owner, as he grew up, demanded that the slaves on the plantation sing. So they made up music. And I think the most important thing about that music is that the huge array of Negro spirituals, you cannot find a word of hate. And you cannot find demeaning words about other people. And at the same time, there is the drive that we will not let our present situation remain or keep us down or destroy our souls. Go down, Moses, let my people go. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. So there's a fight sense, a resistance sense, but it's not resistance of the kind of enmity in the Negro spiritual. So we sang, we sang a lot of the Negro spirituals in the movement, and we also put new words to them. Ain't gonna let segregation turn me around. Whereas the song went, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. So we ain't gonna let segregation, ain't gonna let Bull Connors turn me around. Hmm. Any number of songs. We Shall Overcome is an old song, very old song, which Guy Carawan transformed, and we in Nashville introduced it to the civil rights movement, therefore. So many of the songs were our favorites, and when we were arrested and in jails, I pushed deliberately the notion to take music with you and sing and make up music. So we did a lot of singing in jails, Mississippi and elsewhere.
Do you have a Negro spiritual that comes to mind right now that you think we should end this conversation with, that perhaps is a good message for our times?
The one that I often think about and use is, I ain't gonna study war no more. 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 I ain't gonna study war no more.
Reverend Lawson, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to be in your presence and to talk with you, and to have you come to Iowa to share your thoughts with an audience in Iowa City.
Well, I appreciate you having me for this recording session.
A conversation I had yesterday with the Reverend James Lawson. Lawson spoke yesterday at the Johnson County Senior Center as part of the center's celebration of the human rights movement and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. The University of Northern Iowa School of Music's George Walker Society of Music will be featured in a concert this Sunday at 3 p.m. Members of the society will present a celebration of America's cultural treasure, the Negro Spiritual. Joining me now from Iowa Public Radio Studios on the campus of UNI in Cedar Falls to talk about it, Celeste Bembry, recruiter for UNI's College of Humanities and Fine Arts and an advisor to the university's George Walker Society of Music. Good afternoon to you, Celeste.
Good afternoon.
Hope you were listening to the end of that conversation with Reverend Lawson.
I was, and amazed.
I know you've been in the congregation when he's presided.
Absolutely. I'm from Los Angeles and a member of the arts community there, and have had many collaborations with Holman Methodist Church in Los Angeles, and it's very near my home church, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Los Angeles.
Celeste, tell us about this Sunday's performance, the event, the range of Negro spirituals that will be performed.
With pleasure. The students and community are coming together to present a program that will give samplings of a variety of spirituals from the traditional setting and the evolution of spirituals. And the major categories are concert spirituals, where performers like Roland Hayes, becoming the first African-American tenor who was a significant figure to take the spiritual and make it an art form, Marian Anderson. And so we will do perform a set of concert spirituals for voice and piano, and we have soprano, tenor, and baritone executing those pieces, and then we'll evolve into a contemporary treatment on a spiritual melody, and we will sing works that will have jazz influence, very modern 21st century piano treatments to a spiritual melody.
Mm-hmm. So you've used the word evolve a couple of times already. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, from their inception in the United States, the Negro spiritual, how has it evolved? Can you generally say, for instance, it's become more sophisticated or just more diversified?
Sure. A little of both. A little of both. The art form was simply voice, and whether it be solo work or choral. The first persons that I think of are the Fisk Jubilee Singers of Fisk University, going to Europe to fundraise for Fisk University, and Queen Victoria, having lost King Albert at the time, was at the concert. She was behind a mourning veil in the concert hall, and the performers sang these beautiful harmonies of lamentation, and there was the success of hearing these melodies off of our shores for the first time, and literally it put the genre of the Negro spiritual on the map.
Lamentations. These are some of the themes of the spirituals. Lamentations. Mm-hmm. What else is going on in a Negro spiritual generally?
Lots of hope and lots of communication. There are celebratory messages in the spirituals, but also very intelligent and strategic planning. A great camp meeting in the promised land. While working and singing music, as Pastor Lawson had talked about, that mandate to sing, well, they're developed coded messages all throughout the spirituals. And so that the great camp meeting is that we're meeting tonight somewhere. You know,
So the picture is we have the overseers there, mm-hmm. the slaves in the fields,
yep.
and they are singing these things. The overseers are not even aware of these coded messages.
Correct, because the opinion of the European Americans at that time is that these Africans didn't have enough intelligence to even think to plan.
Mm.
So it was kind of easy. Their ignorance was our bliss.
Celeste, I know you have a beautiful singing voice. I don't know if I can put you on the spot here. Do you have an example of what you're talking about? Some of the an example from a spiritual that you might share a phrase or two with us?
Sure, sure. Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus. There's a little sampling.
Steal away to Jesus. That
yes.
could be a coded message, I guess. Huh?
Absolutely.
So let's listen to a little recording that you've brought for us today. This mm-hmm. is a recording, and something similar to this is what will be heard on Sunday in Cedar Falls.
That is...
We want to mention it's at the First Presbyterian Church at 3 p.m.
That's right.
And that's in Waterloo.
In Waterloo. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this recording.
The recording is from a excuse me, a very important choral ensemble, a professional choral ensemble, of which I've had the pleasure to tour the world, almost 30 countries, singing this art genre of music. It's the Albert McNeil Jubilee Singers. And from the seed of that, a little off branch is the Spirit Chorale. And the voices that you hear in this recording are the Spirit Chorale of Los Angeles. The piece is by Fela Sowande. He is a Nigerian organist, professor, and composer, and arranged this work that is lush with polyphony and structures that are just gorgeous.
And once again, the title of the piece?
It's called Nobody Knows the Trouble I See.
Oh, we know this one. Let's listen to it. The Spirit Chorale from Los Angeles recorded. Celeste, I really get the sense, even through my headphones, of the power of these spirituals. I'm imagining myself in the church on Sunday there listening to that. It's a moving experience to have a full-blown choir with these.
Well, those were 15 voices.
Only 15?
Just 15.
Wow.
A small ensemble. And there are at least 40 in the Albert McNeil Jubilee Singers, of which this is an offshoot. The second generation of this 40-year-old institution of Negro spiritual professional ensemble, and those 12 to 15 voices.
Hmm. Can we imagine the civil rights movement bringing it to more contemporary times, the 20th century, out of times of slavery, the civil rights movement without the backdrop, the integration of Negro spiritual music?
Repeat that question, please.
Well, another way of saying it might be to say, you talked about the lamentations, the hope, the coded messages that it served in a time of slavery. Did it continue to serve those same functions in the civil rights movement?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are songs, Walk Together, Children, Don't You Get Weary. The intent, the commitment, the sacrifice is all in that text, and it lives today. It's one of our favorite songs to sing on our program. Mm.
This is a funny way to end this segment because it goes back to what are the roots of Negro spirituals in the U.S.? The first ones were sung when?
Well, that's an unknown. That is an unknown. The history of them are rooted in, for instance, here's the for instance. Something we will talk about in our program is Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, according to the Library of Congress, specifies that the words are by John Newton. We can suppose that the spirituals are based on a pentatonic scale. European scale is diatonic. And if we were to sing, Every Time I Feel the Spirit, it's on five black notes. Case in point, Amazing Grace on those same five black notes, the melody has come forward, and we can only imagine that John Newton, who was the captain of the slave ships coming over, that what he heard is the moaning in this pentatonic scale. And we get to talk about that in this program and celebrate that this anthem that the world knows, Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace. It's on the African scale and not the European diatonic scale.
Celeste, I sure hope you're part of this choir.
I am.
Okay, very good. Let's remind people, we have to go. We want to hear a little bit more of the recording of the Spirit Chorale from Los Angeles. But to remind our listeners about this event, go ahead. Remind us. It's when? Where?
It is this Sunday, 3 p.m., and the weather should be good that day.
No ice, please.
No ice. 3 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in Waterloo. The address is 505 Franklin Street. The intersections are 4th and Franklin, and it's across the street from KWWL. Okay. Don't miss this concert.
And it's open to the public, free, no admittance.
No admission. However, the George Walker Society would accept donations to continue to promote this wonderful art form.
Okay, Celeste, thank you very much for joining us.
My
and
pleasure.
Good luck with this event.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Okay, very good. Celeste Bembry, recruiter for UNI's College of Humanities and Fine Arts and an advisor to the university's George Walker Society of Music. That event this Sunday, 3 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Waterloo. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Our producer assistant today, Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.